Okay, so today we start applying quantum field theory to cosmology. This is the thing we're dealing with, our universe. I'm almost amazed by pictures like that. And imagine if it wasn't for the atmosphere, we would see that during the day too, right? It's just because of the scattering of sunlight from the air molecules that the sky looks blue. Otherwise, on the moon, that's what you see during the day too. Anywhere else, and if you're not looking at directly at the sun, that's how it looks like on the moon. Anyway, so we're going to look at the universe as a whole, cosmology. And there are some key observations that we take as starting points for our models. And one key observation is that on large scales, the universe is pretty much flat. And by large scale, we mean larger than a billion light years. So if you average over a billion light years, then the universe is very flat. Which means that if you take a a laser pointer, a really strong one, and you create a triangle in the universe whose side lengths are of the order of a billion light years, you will find that the sum of the angles is pretty accurately 180 degrees. Very, very accurately. When really, it, there's no reason for that in principle. It could easily be larger or smaller depending on what the overall curvature of space-time might be. But for some reason that we will have to discuss, the universe is extremely flat in space. The expansion of the universe is very isotropic. It turns out that the expansion rate doesn't depend on the direction in which you look. Again, that's something that is not trivial, because space-time is something dynamical. It could do all sorts of things. And so it's something remarkable that that is the case. So we have that the universe is extremely flat on large enough length scales. It's homogeneous in the sense that it looks the same everywhere. And it also looks the same in each direction, so it's isotropic. And the expansion itself is isotropic as well, and homogeneous. It's everywhere the same and has no preference for either location or orientation. So this leads us to model the evolution of space-time on large scales, crudely, as a Friedman-Robertson-Walker-Lemaître space-time. So we make the simplifying assumption in order to arrive at these models that the universe has no spatial curvature at all. Of course, it has at smaller scales, such as the solar system or our galaxy. But on large enough scales, it's pretty much flat. And the, we also model that the expansion is isotropic, as we discussed. By the way, it is known that the Einstein equations allow for highly non-trivial evolutions. And by that, I mean evolutions that are not just, they're not intuitive, because they arise from the non-linear nature of the Einstein equations. There are evolutions which are non-isotropic, and yet, at a certain point in time, they can look pretty much like our universe. So in principle, just because it looks the way that it does look now, doesn't really tell us exactly what the solution is, what the dynamics of the universe is. We would have to watch it for a while in order to really see what's going on. But we generally go by the simplest model, and the simplest models are those FRWL space-times. So now with these assumptions, let us choose coordinates. We will need to choose a suitable time coordinate for cosmology and suitable space coordinates. Now for the time coordinate, let us consider what is called the Hubble flow. You see, in the universe, there is lots of motion. All the galaxies are moving away from us. Not all of them. Andromeda is moving towards us, but all galaxies from a certain distance onward are moving away from us. And the further they are away, the faster they move. That's because of the expansion of the universe. So there are lots of velocities going on. And of course, velocity impacts the measurement of time. So it's not trivial to single out a particular notion of time as what we might call cosmic time. And it turns out that fundamentally, there's no such thing as cosmic time. But within the approximations that we are working, there is such a thing as cosmic time. So to arrive at that, let's start with a definition. We say that the motion of galaxies, which is entire, that part of the motion of galaxies, which is entirely due to the cosmic expansion, is called the Hubble flow. So for example, our galaxy, the Milky Way, and some other galaxy far away are moving away from another, but mostly because there is space being created between us. So in principle, these galaxies are just sitting where they are, but underneath them, the universe is expanding. So part of the motion of galaxies is just the overall expansion of the universe. But then on top of that, and that's the Hubble flow, but on top of that, galaxies can also have what is called peculiar motion. So the peculiar velocity of a galaxy or any observer is the usually small extra random velocity that galaxies can possess relative to the general Hubble flow. So for example, the Milky Way and our neighbor, the Andromeda galaxy, are moving towards each other. That has nothing to do with the Hubble flow. This is just because they're close enough to be significantly attracted to each other gravitationally. This is peculiar velocity. So we distinguish among the motion of galaxies the Hubble flow and the peculiar motion relative to the Hubble flow. Now, let us use the following definition for a cosmic time variable. As the time coordinate, the cosmic time t, let us use the proper time t of a freely streaming observer who has no peculiar velocity. So imagine a galaxy that has no close neighbors, a galaxy that's just sitting there and floating in the universe as the universe is expanding. Assume a galaxy that has no peculiar velocity. Then observers in that galaxy would find on their wristwatch what we call the cosmic time, the coordinate time, which is the proper time. We call the cosmic time the proper time on the wristwatch of observers that do not have peculiar velocity. They just move with the Hubble flow. So in principle, they're just sitting there and the universe is expanding. And to a good approximation, our wristwatches are cosmic time, indicate cosmic time.
Sorry? No peculiar velocity with respect to what?
To the Hubble flow. So in principle, if all galaxies were super distant away from each other, so that they don't have any attraction to each other, and if the processes that generated galaxies had not endowed them with any extra velocity somewhere, they would just be sitting there. The universe expands, which means that the galaxies move away from each other, but just by sitting there, just by, you know, it's like raisins in a cookie dough. When that cookie dough moves, expands, then the raisins move apart from each other, but they're not actually moving relative to the cookie dough. And so similarly here with the galaxies. So we use as our time variable in some approximation, we use the proper time of observers that go with Hubble flow. Now, fundamentally, this is not a good definition. And that's because there is no such thing as the Hubble flow alone. It's an approximation that there is some general Hubble flow. There is no sharp separation between Hubble flow and peculiar velocity, just because of the fact that the universe is not entirely isotropic and homogeneous. It's just in a very good approximation. So for practical purposes, that's a very good definition. But it's not something that you can base quantum gravity on, or something that you could say this is a preferred time variable in the universe. It's not. Strictly speaking, there are many, many such definitions that are for practical purposes the same, but differ by small ambiguities in what velocity we assign to Hubble flow and what velocity we assign to peculiar motion. So it's a practical, it's an engineering kind of variable, not fundamental physics. Then what about, within our Friedman-Robertson-Walker Lemaître space times, it is going to be a fundamental thing, right? But that makes sense because the approximations that go into FRWL space times are such that there are peculiar, that there are a lot of symmetries, and then there is a unique cosmic time in that sense.
But saying that it is not fundamental, I mean, is that true for all possible definitions? For example, yeah. What if we would define it by the CMB temperature?
We will get to that later in the course. Yes, you might think that one way to do it is to say that equal time is where the CMB temperature is the same. But you could also say it's equal time is where the curvature is flat. And these are just two slicings of space-times into space-like hypersurfaces that are related by gauge transformation. And we'll get to that. Later, I mean, you see, this is just the first setup. We will refine over that because the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field and of the metric will make space-time inhomogeneous. They will make space-time evolve in some places more and in some places less. They will make space-time expand in some places faster and some places slower. And it's exactly these fluctuations in there that eventually generate inhomogeneities in the universe. And then we'll have to define those inhomogeneities. We will have to see what is truly an inhomogeneity and what is just an apparent inhomogeneity, which is caused by our choice of coordinates, by our choice of slicing of space-time. That's historically, it was a very difficult exercise to do, and many papers were written that were not quite right until sometime after like 15, 20 years, it was figured out how to do this correctly. Okay, so we have a time coordinate for the universe. Now, what about space coordinates? Again, assuming homogeneity and isotropy, it is convenient to use so-called co-moving coordinates. So this is a coordinate system, a spatial coordinate system that we define at every point in time. Cosmic time, coordinates x1, x2, x3. And in order to do that, we pick a time. And traditionally, we use today. I mean, in practice, T0 is like our epoch. And then we set at our cosmic time T0 today, we set up a rectangular ordinary coordinate system. So you could take these tables as standard unit length rulers, and then attach gazillions of them in each direction, and you get a rectangular coordinate system, and that is going to be our co-moving coordinate system at the time T0 of today. But then, what should be our spatial coordinate system at other times? We could just be lazy and keep the same coordinate system at all times with the desks and so on. But no, it will be very convenient to use co-moving coordinates in the sense that at earlier times, we will use smaller tables. And at later times, we will use larger tables. In this way, the numerical coordinates of a galaxy, for example, stay the same in time. See, what we are defining here is a coordinate system that grows with the universe, or shrinks as you go back in time. In such a way, just a sec, in such a way that all the galaxies keep their numerical coordinates, assuming they have no peculiar velocity. So a galaxy that has no peculiar velocity has numerically the same coordinates, x1, x2, x3, at all times. But of course, the universe is expanding. And so, for example, two galaxies that have no peculiar velocity will have their three numerical coordinates always the same. But what distance that means changes, because tables that we use as units actually grow. So think of an actual coordinate system that grows with the universe at exactly the same rate. The point being that in this way, the Hubble flow is numerically frozen. So everything that just moves with the Hubble flow doesn't have a velocity. And the only velocities you see in that coordinate system are peculiar velocities. Yeah?
We can only set up the rectangular coordinate system because it's flat space-time.
Right? That's right. Yes, on a generic curved space-time, you could not guarantee that everything works out with right angles. You can always triangulate, but you can't always get Cartesian. All right, so we set up a coordinate system that grows with the universe, and that's rectangular. So the advantages are that in the co-moving coordinate system, galaxies have constant coordinates, except if they have peculiar motion. And also, what does it mean for waves? Imagine you shoot a laser beam tonight out into the universe, and it has, I don't know, wavelengths 400 nanometers. Then it will keep wavelengths 400 nanometers for a while. But eventually, it will be noticeably different, the wavelengths, because the universe expands underneath the laser beam that you sent. And if you come back billions and billions of years later and watch your laser beam, catch up with it. No, you can't catch up with it, but somebody else observes it many, many years later, they will find it's redder. The wavelength has been stretched. But in the co-moving coordinate system, numerically, the wavelength is still the same, because the coordinate system grew with the universe. Okay, so wavelengths are constant in the co-moving coordinate system. That's going to be super useful for the Klein-Gordon equation. Because if you remember why we went into the Fourier domain in Minkowski space, remember we had the Klein-Gordon equation in the position in Minkowski space at first. And then we looked at it and we said, aha, at every point in space, we have a harmonic oscillator. But in position space, these harmonic oscillators are coupled because of the Laplacian term. It has derivatives. And these harmonic oscillators must be coupled. Right? If you throw a stone into a lake, then you will excite the water not only where the stone went in, but now waves will propagate outward. Which is to say that in the lake, each harmonic oscillator is coupled to its neighbors. That's why waves can spread. But we don't want that. For mathematical simplicity, it's easier if you have harmonic oscillators that are isolated, that are independent of each other, that don't excite each other. That's what we achieve by doing the Fourier transform with the Klein-Gordon equation, if you remember. Then the spatial derivatives became just multiplications. And so in the Fourier domain, the Klein-Gordon field became just harmonic oscillators that were independent. For every momentum, for every wave vector, for every momentum 3 vector, we had an independent harmonic oscillator. And that makes sense. If you, in Minkowski space, create an excitation in a harmonic oscillator for a particular wavelength, for example, you shoot a laser beam, then in Minkowski space, it's not going to change its color. right? So you excite one harmonic oscillator, the harmonic oscillator at one point in momentum space, and that will not spread. You will just have excited that one harmonic oscillator for one point in momentum space. But in curved space-time, we just saw that if you create something with a particular wavelength, with a particular momentum, then after a while it will have a different momentum, which is to say that in space, in expanding space-time, the harmonic oscillators of the modes are coupled to each other. They hand the excitation to each other. What used to be an excitation of 400 nanometers becomes an excitation of 500 nanometers of a while later. And we will later see how that shows up in the differential equations. But we avoid that by going to co-moving coordinate systems. If we use a co-moving coordinate system, then still it's the case that if you excite a harmonic oscillator for a particular wavelength, it and only it will be excited in the future. Right? Because this harmonic oscillator in co-moving coordinates always has the same numerical wavelength, even though it describes something that is actually expanding. So this coordinate system, the co-moving coordinate system, will achieve, as we will later see, the task of decoupling the Klein-Gordon equation into uncoupled, independent harmonic oscillators. The Klein-Gordon equation always starts out as a partial differential equation, but after suitable transformations, and in this case, it's not just a Fourier transform, it's a Fourier transform after going to a co-moving coordinate system that will achieve that the partial differential equation of the Klein-Gordon type will become just a bunch of independent ordinary differential equations, each one for harmonic oscillator. All right, so we have cosmic time and we have co-moving coordinates. Now, how does the metric look like? Remember, generally the invariant distance squared, infinitesimal invariant distance squared between two events, is given through the metric in this way. It's the invariant Ford distance. Now, in our coordinates, cosmic time and co-moving space coordinates, the metric must be of this form. And why do we have a 1 here? Well, we have a 1 here because cosmic time is the time on a wristwatch. So there's a 1 here. It should be exactly what we measure on a wristwatch. If there's no motion in space, if there are no dx's going on, only dx zeros, then the proper time is the coordinate time. That's what we have here. Proper time is coordinate time, is the universal time, cosmic time. However, we must have some time-dependent quantities in here, the so-called scale factor. And the reason is that with our co-moving, our choice of a co-moving coordinate system, we have that the same numerical distance, dx, means an increasing actual proper distance over time. So we must have that the coordinate distance is related to the proper distance with a scale factor. If the whole thing is squared, we put here scale factor squared. OK, so the metric will look like this. And of course, the fact that this is the same as that, that's just the, that these are the same is isotropy of the universe, and that they don't depend on space is the homogeneity of the universe. OK, so the scale factor, A of t. The scale factor function A of t allows us to calculate distances in the universe than at any time. So for example, let's say we take two galaxies at the same cosmic time, and they have a cosmic distance described by this distance vector here, delta x1, delta x2, delta x3, at some fixed proper time t, but we are looking at their distance at a fixed cosmic time, at the same cosmic time for both of them, so there's no delta t, there's no delta x0, just the delta x1. And since the metric is constant over space, we don't need to integrate. We can just calculate directly what the proper distance is between the two galaxies. Just take the distance vector and the metric here, take the absolute value and the square root. And what we see here is that then the numerical distance between the galaxies in the co-moving coordinate system is related to the proper distance, the actual distance, via the scale factor A of t. So what then is the dynamics of A of t? You see, in this simple picture here, all of the non-triviality of the expansion of the universe, of the shape of the universe, is encoded in this one function A of t that doesn't even depend on space and time. Space and time, it just depends on time. The model is very severely constrained. Because of homogeneity and isotropy, we have just this one function here. And by the way, what does it mean in terms of curvature? We don't have spatial curvature. Right? By assumption, you built it in that there's no spatial curvature. It turns out that A of t basically expresses the non-trivial evolution of A of t, the expansion of space-time or shrinkage, is basically expressing curvature between space and time. Curvature between space and space is virtually non-existent at sufficiently large distances. But the curvature between space and time, that is what expansion and shrinkage is about. Okay, so but what is the dynamics of the universe? What's the dynamics of A of t? Well, in order to determine what A of t is, we have to solve a few equations of motion. Let's quickly go through the steps. We have to calculate the energy momentum tensor of all the fields. So we have matter fields, radiation fields, electron quarks and gluons, and all the sorts of particles that we know about and that we don't know about yet, they all contribute to the energy momentum tensor. In particular, dark matter, for example, contributes to the energy momentum tensor. So there are fields out there, matter and radiation fields, phi, and we just label them with an index here. So electronic fields would be a particular value of I. The field for a particular quark would be a phi with another index. We just lump them all together. They all contribute to the energy momentum tensor. And we need to know which contribution is dominant in this. What's the overall shape of t mu nu, of t and x? So first we calculate the energy momentum tensor in terms of the fields, all of the physical fields. And then we have to solve simultaneously the equations of motion for the fields, that includes the Dirac equation for the electron and the Maxwell equation for the photons, and then the equations of QCD, and so on and so on. In principle, we have to solve all of those equations of motion for all of the matter and radiation fields, and we have to solve the Einstein equation for the metric, but we make the assumption here that the metric is not just some general covariant symmetric two tensor, but that the metric is of this particular form, which of course also requires that the energy momentum tensor is isotropic and homogeneous, and therefore also that the average distribution of all the matter fields is homogeneous and isotropic, which is a fairly good assumption over length scales of a billion light years and more. So you see, the task is enormous. We need to solve the equations of motion for the matter and radiation fields, such as the Dirac equation and the Maxwell equations, all of which are influenced by non-trivial metric. And then on the other hand, we have to solve also the Einstein equation. And the Einstein equation is influenced by what the matter fields do. So we have two sets of equations that are coupled. This equation is an equation for the metric, and it is influenced by the presence of matter because the matter fields enter into the energy momentum tensor, and vice versa, the equations of motion for the matter fields have the metric all over the place. And all of this should be calculated, all of this should be solved quantum theoretically, not just classically. Anyway, we make a dramatic simplification here by assuming homogeneity and isotropy, and the metric then has only this one unknown function in it. That is a huge help in this. Also, we will, for now, later we will try to improve over that, we will form what is called the semi-classical approximation. And the reason is that we can't solve all of those equations quantum mechanically, but we can solve them classically. And yet we want some quantum information as well. So what we do is quantize the matter fields. We know how to do that, quantizing matter fields. I mean, we just spent the last few lectures on how to do this, at least for the Klein-Gordon field. So in principle, even if the background is curved, even if there's a non-trivial metric, we can still solve the quantum theory for the fields, for the matter and radiation fields. At least in principle, we know how to go about it, even when in practice it's very difficult. But to quantize the metric, well, nobody has quite solved that problem. So in the first approximation, what we'll do is this. We'll solve for the quantum theory of the matter fields, or at least the fields or the field that dominates in the very early universe where we are mostly interested in. So we will solve the quantum field theory for the dominant matter field, which will be the inflaton field, on the background of a classical space-time by calculating the matter fields, the operator-valued matter fields, calculating from them what the energy momentum tensor is, and then plugging that into the Einstein equation. But there is a problem, which is that the Einstein equation, here it is, the Einstein equation has on the left-hand side various terms in terms of the curvature and the cosmological constant and the metric, and on the right-hand side, the energy momentum tensor, which for quantum fields is operator value. Right? So phi hat is a function of space and time. And its derivatives with respect to time and space are also operator-valued functions of space and time. So the whole thing is an expression in operator-valued fields and their canonically conjugate momenta. But on the left-hand side, we have no operators. It's just curvature. It's just number-valued functions there, or tensor-valued functions, but not operator-valued functions. So the idea is, in the semi-classical approximation, that we take simply an expectation values on the right-hand, an expectation value on the right-hand side, which is to say that we take the operator-valued energy momentum tensor, and then if omega is the state of the quantum field or the quantum fields, then we use omega to calculate the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor. And that is now just a symmetric two-tensor valued field. That's what we put on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. Clearly, that is not ideal. It would be much better to know what the left-hand side of the Einstein equation is in terms of operators, but we don't. And on top of that, there is a conceptual issue too. Fundamentally speaking, energy and momentum are not to be localized. We know from the uncertainty principle that if you know the energy, you don't know when. And if you know the momentum, you don't know where, and vice versa. But here, we are writing down an energy-momentum tensor, which tells us at exactly in principle, or it tries to tell us in principle, exactly at what time and space, what energy and momentum density we have. Can't be right. Not fundamentally. Of course, it doesn't really matter when we are talking about things as big as a galaxy. But as a matter of principle, that is not a safe thing to do. So in principle, this is a recipe for calculating an evolution of the universe. Work with the quantum fields quantum theoretically. Try to solve the equations of motion, while at the same time, try to solve the Einstein equation. And the two are coupled in the following way. the equations of motion of the matter fields have the metric in them. That couples them to the curvature. And vice versa, the Einstein equation has the matter fields in them, but only the expectation values of the energy momentum tensor. Now, for a start, we will simply assume that the scale factor A of t has been determined by other means, or somebody has done the calculation already. So we know what A of t is, and then we calculate what the quantum theory of a field is on that expanding space-time. In principle, it's a give and take. In principle, it's a back and forth. What the matter fields are doing is going to affect what space-time does, and what space-time does is going to affect what the matter fields do. For now, we will assume that the space-time's evolution is given, and we will just calculate what the matter fields are doing. The justification for that will come later. Let me just give you a preview of what the justification for that is. The justification is that it is actually a very good approximation to assume that the matter fields are classical and gravity is classical if all you're interested in is the big evolution. If all you're interested in is the evolution of a homogeneous isotropic universe, then what we're dealing with is humongous energies. And the fluctuations around the expectations are very small. On the big scale, it's a good approximation to say we just work with the classical fields and the classical energy momentum tensor that they produce, and then we calculate the back and forth between what space-time wants to do classically and what quantum fields want to do classically. And then once you've done all of this, and we will cover that a little later, once we've done all of this, we will have a model of space-time where we have how space-time expands and how matter behaves on it, everything classical. Right? And that's actually doable. Because we have so much symmetry in the game here, we can actually do this. We can do it at least numerically, but in many cases even analytically. And then once we have that, once we solve the classical problem of the interplay between space-time and the matter fields, the bulk of the matter fields, then we can go about refining that picture. And we say, yeah, but actually, maybe it wasn't so completely homogeneous. Maybe it wasn't completely isotropic. At least quantum fluctuations will break that homogeneity. Quantum fluctuations will break the isotropy. So then we look at small extra contributions that come from quantum fluctuations on top of that. And that's what we will do for the next few hours. We will assume that a classical evolution of space-time is given, and then we ask, what does a quantum field do with it? And then eventually we bring it all together. We'll do the classical calculation where classical gravity, classical fields give us the classical bulk evolution with full symmetry, isotropy, and homogeneity of space-time. Then how is that picture modified by the quantum fluctuations? And finally, also, how do fluctuations of gravity itself impact that too? And then we get a relatively complete picture, and we arrive at the modern standard model of cosmology. All right, so for the purposes that we have in mind, which is, just to make sure, what happened? I don't know how we ended up there. Okay. Okay, so we want to study quantum field theory on a fixed background space-time, fixed classical background space-time to start with. For that purpose, it will be convenient to change our coordinate system a little bit. Remember, our coordinate system was chosen in such a way that the metric took this form. These factors are there because we have co-moving coordinates. These factors change the co-moving distances into actual physical proper distances. in a co-moving coordinate system, and that's a one because cosmic time was the proper time on the wristwatch of observers that just go with the Hubble flow without peculiar velocity. Now, it would be, for mathematical reasons, really convenient if space and time were treated the same, if this one was not a one, but an a squared, because then we could pull the a squared in front, and then we could say that the metric is up to a prefactor, just eta, just a special relativistic metric. That would mean that space-time is conformally the same as Minkowski space. It would be Minkowski space eta up to a conformal prefactor, just up to a prefactor that just changes the overall size. And it turns out that is the case for FRWL space-times. It is the case that they are the same as Minkowski space up to expansion, up to a prefactor in front of it. It's called a conformal prefactor because it can change the length of vectors, but not the angle, right? Because the metric itself doesn't change in its structure at all, only a prefactor changes. It's not a trivial thing that this can be done, but it can be in this case. So how do we achieve this? Well, we achieve this by choosing a new time coordinates eta, which will be called conformal time. And conformal time is chosen in such a way that in terms of the conformal time, the metric will have an a squared term here. For that purpose, what do we need? We need that the dt squared, where t is cosmic time, is a squared times the new time, the conformal time. If we can achieve that, if we can find a time variable eta such that this is true, well then the delta t squared term that arises from this one becomes an a squared delta eta squared term. But that's easy to achieve. Let's just take the square root of all of this, and then we obtain that the requirement on the new time variable is that a times d eta is dt, but that gives us a differential equation. And the differential equation is that d eta by dt is 1 over a. And of course, a is a function of t. And we can integrate that. So eta of t is the integral of 1 over a of t prime dt prime, starting from some starting time that's completely arbitrary to the present time. The choice of starting time here is arbitrary because it just adds a constant. It's just determining the numerical value of the time, of the new time coordinate at whatever point you want. The important thing is this functional relationship between the two. So we are rescaling the time variable. These clocks do not tick in the usual way. It's a rescaled time coordinate. But in general relativity, we are free to choose whatever coordinates we want. So this new time variable eta, which can be calculated once you have the a of t, or you can just calculate everything starting out with the eta. This new time variable is called, as I said, the conformal time. So now using conformal time and co-moving spatial coordinates, the metric takes this form. It's a squared times the eta metric of special relativity. Now notice that we have two etas in the game now. We have the conformal time variable eta, and we have the eta mu nu, which is the metric of Minkowski space. They have, of course, nothing to do with each other. It's just try not to confuse the two different uses of the symbol eta. This also implies that we can immediately write down what the inverse metric is. So the metric with the upper indices is the inverse matrix to the metric with the lower indices, because it's just the Kronecker delta mu nu. So it's literally the inverse matrix, and therefore it too is just proportional to the eta mu nu of special relativity, now with the upper indices. But that factor is, of course, just 1 over what used to be the factor for the g with the lower indices. A squared became a to the power of minus 2. We will need, in order to write down the Klein-Gödel equation and the action for it and so on, we will need the metric with the lower indices, the metric with the upper indices, and it will also come up in the measure of the integral and for the Laplacian or for the D'Alembert operator, for example, what the square root is of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric. And now we can calculate that easily, of course. Take the metric with lower indices, so each element on the diagonal is proportional to a squared. The determinant of it is therefore a to the 8th power. And then we take the absolute value of that and the square root of it, and that gives us a to the 4th power. So the metric, this measure factor is just a to the 4th power. The metric with the upper indices is proportional to a to the power minus 2. The metric with the lower indices is proportional to a squared. Now we have all the ingredients to write down the Klein-Gödel field in cosmological space-time. So for now, let's assume the possible existence of a potential for the Klein-Gödel field. So we just look at the free Klein-Gödel field that has a kinetic term and that has potentially a mass term. So here is the Klein-Gödel field as we had written it down earlier on a cosmological background. Kinetic term and mass term. And now, this is the general formula. And now on a cosmological background, this is the form it takes. Remember, the g with the upper indices is just the eta with the upper indices and the prefactor of a to the power minus 2. That's here and and there. And this was a to the power 4. So here it is. And our variables are now d eta, d3x. Co-moving distances, conformal time. Remember the general Klein-Gödel equation that arose from the Euler-Lagrange equation? So if you do if you apply the variational principle to the general action, this is the general Klein-Gödel equation that you obtain. And if we do that in particular for the action here, what do we obtain? Well, let's consider the general Euler-Lagrange equation and plug in what we have. This is equal to a to the power minus 2 times eta. So we have, So this is a to the 4th power, and this is a to the power minus 2 times eta. So that gives us an a to the 2nd power times eta. Oh, and that is an 1 over a to the 4th power. And that's it. So that's the Klein-Gödel equation here on an expanding space-time. It looks like it just has second derivatives, but it actually has more than second derivatives. It also has a first derivative. And the reason is that this d by dx mu contains also the case of d by dx 0. And that will differentiate our scale factor, which depends on the conformal time. So let's see what we obtain when we work it out. That term becomes this term. This eta goes over here. And then the a squared term goes over there. And we have these two derivatives. That's one term that we get. But as we said, we also have the case where this derivative, namely the time derivative, gets caught on this and produces a 2a prime. And we will use the notation a prime as the derivative with respect to the conformal time. So a prime is dA by d eta. So we also get a term where we have this carried forward over here. Then the eta gets carried forward oh no, we don't need the eta anymore because it's only one special case. It's d by dx zero. And that means we have eta 0, 0, which is 1. And then we have the derivative, this derivative acting on a squared. So we get 2a prime a. And we have the derivative d by dx 0, this one. Because remember, mu has to be equal to nu. And this is 0, and the nu also has to be 0. So we get that term. All right. So overall then, if we write out these derivatives, we obtain a second time derivative from the case eta 0, 0, and we obtain second space derivatives from the case eta ii. Putting it all together, we obtain that the second time derivative here gives us this term. Actually, there's an a squared, a to the 4, so it's 1 over a squared. We from here to here, we multiply the entire equation with a squared. So for example, the m squared term picks up an a squared term here. And this term and that term would have a 1 over a squared from 1 over a to the 4 times a squared. But we multiply the entire equation with a squared, so these don't have prefactors. And then we have this offending term here, this one, over here. Now you see, this is qualitatively something new. We have not seen anything of that kind before in this course. See, the Klein-Gordon equation in a cosmological space-time has this form here. Second time derivative, conformal time, and then something multiplying the first time derivative of phi, and then something multiplying phi. This is like a harmonic oscillator, but it's like a harmonic oscillator with a friction term, right? If you put a first derivative into a harmonic oscillator, it's like a friction term, or an anti-friction term, depending on the sign of it. So it's either that energy gets dissipated out of the harmonic oscillator, or somehow pumped into it. Well, which is because the universe is expanding. It's actually messing with our harmonic oscillators. And still, it's inconvenient. It's inconvenient to have this thing because we didn't use it we didn't deal with these first time derivatives so far in the course. And generally, one tries to avoid these things because the proper formalism would be to expand the system and then look at dissipation and so on. However, there is an alternative to this, which is an elegant shortcut, which is that instead of working with the variable phi, we can work with a slightly modified variable phi, the variable that we will call chi. And if we then rewrite that equation in terms of the new variable, if we choose the new variable cleverly, we get rid of this term. It's something like a completion of the squares. Instead of having a linear term, we can define a new variable in which we have only second derivatives and no derivatives. So this can actually be done. We should never forget that we've done this, right? The new field is not the physical field. The physical field is phi. The new field is a mathematical helper. It's just some convenient mathematical tool, but the physical field is the phi field. So what we want to do is we want to try to change from using the field phi to a new variable, chi, in an invertible way, such that the equation of motion for the new field chi has no friction term, no friction type term. And it should be done in an invertible way so that once we have the solution for chi, we should be quickly able to also write down what the solution for phi is. And in fact, it can be done without much fuss. Let's start with the field phi, multiply it with the scale factor a, And then that product we call the new field variable chi, or chi. Chi of eta and x is our new field variable. I will show you in a moment that this ansatz succeeds and we get rid of the friction term. But let's look at what we roughly should expect here. What's the dynamics between the phi and the chi? You see, chi is the phi field multiplied with the scale factor. Now, we expect, because we've heard about it before, that the universe is going to have a period, or had a period, of extremely fast expansion, which means that this scale factor went crazy, had an almost exponential rate of increase with a very high coefficient in the exponent. What that means is that we should look out for what this field chi does. It's not a physical field, but just to see, you know, intuitively what's going on. Even if phi was to be constant, this chi would explode because the scale factor does, right? So even if phi behaves very normally, the chi field has a tendency to get out of hand because the scale factor can grow a lot. And that's what we will observe, in fact, is happening. So just because chi goes to crazily large values doesn't mean phi does. We'd have to divide chi by A to find out what the actual physical field phi does. Okay, so then let's see. We want to re-express the action and the equation of motion in terms of the new variable chi. What do we have? We have that phi is chi divided by A. So we have phi is chi divided by A, and phi prime, the derivative with respect to conformal time of phi, is the derivative with respect to conformal time of 1 over A times chi, which gives us two terms right away. We get one term where this is being differentiated, that's this one, minus A prime over A squared. So the 1 over A got differentiated in this case, and the chi was just carried forward. And another term where we have 1 over A times chi prime. And that's, of course, the key. That's what will get rid of the friction term. And what about the space derivatives of phi? Well, that's totally trivial. The space derivative of phi is the space derivative of chi divided by A, but A doesn't depend on space at all. So we can just pull this through. And so it's just 1 over A, the space derivative of chi. And that's true for all of the three space derivative directions. So now using this, it's an easy exercise to show that the action, that the Klein-Gordon action, becomes, in terms of the chi field, this. Notice that this looks quite different from how the Klein-Gordon action looked in terms of phi. Let me just show you what's going on here. We have just the second time derivative, and then we have here the sum of the second space derivatives. That's just the Laplacian here. And then we have here m squared a squared minus a double prime over a chi squared. So it's a fancy mass term. It's clearly the origin here is the mass term, right? Decorated with an a squared. And then there's some extra thing that plays the role almost of a mass. But here and there, there's no prefactor anymore. There's nothing, there's no non-trivial factor here in front of the measure. Let's compare that with what the action looked like before. Here it is. See, here the action in terms of the field phi looks like this. We have an overall factor here, and over there we have factors. And in terms of phi, specifically for the cosmological case, we have the kinetic terms have this 1 over a squared prefactor. And the mass term, just the mass term, but the whole thing is, again, multiplied with a to the 4. So the main message I want to convey is that the mass term is just as usual, except for a prefactor. But the kinetic terms are definitely somehow non-trivial, because we have here 1 over a squared. That makes a difference when we then calculate the Klein-Gordon equation. Whereas in the new, with the new field variable chi, things look a little bit conceptually simpler because it's just the usual harmonic oscillator of free Klein-Gordon field, as if it was Minkowski space, right? Because it's just the second time derivatives, second space derivatives, as if it was the Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space. And no measure factors in here, as if it was Minkowski space. The only non-triviality is this fancy mass. If you view this as if it was a mass term that now depends on time. Right? So all of the non-triviality of the expansion of the universe is now encoded in this one thing, this effective mass, which would even be there if the field doesn't have a mass. There's this extra contribution here. So we can use all our intuition from Minkowski space quantum field theory to deal with this, except that we have a time-dependent mass. And so what we see is that we have mode oscillators that have the potential to be parametrically driven. Because this is like in the harmonic oscillators, right? This is going to impact what the frequencies are. So this is going to change the parameters of our mode oscillators in a time-dependent way. So we can have parametric driving. And in fact, these guys have opposite sign. And because this thing can dominate over that, we can have that the sign flips. And that means that we end up, actually, this will contribute as well, right? We do a Fourier transform, and then we get a k-squared over here. Right? So there's going to be a k-squared from the Fourier transform of these space derivatives. And so these k-squared are also going to contribute as to the mass term over here. And what can happen is that this term starts dominating over that and that term. And then we have that our mode oscillators have that the potential flips. Instead of being just this, it can go all the way that way. And when the mode oscillator's potential does go that way, well, then we have harmonic oscillators that are runaway systems now. They're no longer oscillating. The potential is downward. And therefore, the amplitude of these harmonic oscillators can go crazy because they run off that inverted potential. We shouldn't jump to the conclusion that the chi field is representative here because, yes, the chi field will go to infinity very quickly. But remember, the phi field is what the physical field is. It has to be divided by the scale factor. So we'll have to keep an eye on this.
So if you have exponential expansion, then A double prime is constant proportional A. So A double prime over A is going to be a constant, right?
Yes, you can have that.
Right. And then M squared A squared is going to get bigger and bigger.
So oh, no, you have to be careful. When you have exponential expansion, it is exponential in cosmic time.
That's right.
But this is going to be conformal time.
Right.
And then it's going to be a little bit different.
Right.
Because the exponential becomes hyperbolic.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just anticipating a lot of things. You're not supposed to see all of the details just yet. I'm just previewing things that are coming up that we can already see a little bit of a hint of. Okay, so now, what I did is I rewrote the action in terms of the chi field. But how do we know that if we vary now with respect to the chi field and set the variation equal to zero, that we get the proper equations of motion? So setting the action functional derivative with respect to phi equal to zero gives us definitely the right equations of motion. But setting the functional derivative with respect to chi equal to zero, does that give us the same equations of motion? Yes, it does. And the reason is that ds by d phi is ds by d chi by d phi, and that's invertible. Right? We made sure that this is invertible, that once you know chi, you can calculate phi, and once you know phi, you can calculate chi, etc. And therefore, that's not zero. And therefore, this being zero implies that's zero, and vice versa. So it's the same thing. Of course, you can also work it out explicitly. It's just more elegant to see it this way. So we can calculate the equations of motion for the chi field in two different ways. We can derive the equation of motion afresh from the Klein-Gordon action in, expressed in the chi field, or we can just take the Klein-Gordon equation in terms of the phi field, substitute the new variable, and get the Klein-Gordon equation in terms of the chi field. So the equation of motion that we then get is simply this one, as is obvious from the action, because the action was the action of Minkowski space quantum field theory, except for the non-trivial mass term. And so we get the usual Klein-Gordon equation of Minkowski space, except for the mass term, which is now this one. So for the chi field, this is the equation of motion. And this paragraph is simply saying there are two ways to get to this, from the action of the chi field, or from the Klein-Gordon equation for phi, and then substituting chi for phi. OK, so this is the thing now that we want to quantize. You see, there's no friction term in this. There's no first derivative term in chi. It's just the usual kind. We should be able to handle this one, to quantize that. And once we've quantized that, we should be able to calculate then, or we will be able easily, to calculate the physical field phi. We just divide by the scale factor. And then we get the physical field phi. OK, so let's prepare now for quantization. We need the canonically conjugate field pi superscript chi in order to impose the canonical commutation relations. And we can easily do that by doing the Legendre transform. So we take the Klein-Gordon action in terms of the field chi, remove the time integration to get the so-called Lagrangian. And here it is. Here's the Lagrangian. It's just the Klein-Gordon action again, but without the time integration. And then we do the Legendre transform with respect to chi prime. So we are asking, what is the canonically conjugate variable to chi prime? And we can calculate that. So we calculate dl by d chi prime. Now chi prime only occurs in here, the conformal time derivative of chi. And so we just get that this is actually chi prime, as easy as it could be. Now, by the way, what is the canonically conjugate field to phi? Here's the Klein-Gordon action in terms of phi. It too has a canonically conjugate field. Let's call it pi superscript phi. Now let's calculate what it is. Well, pi superscript phi is the L by d phi prime. Now phi prime, the time derivative, the conformal time derivative of phi, is occurring in here when, you know, this is when alpha is 0, then you have a time derivative here. And you get that twice, which gets rid of the 1 half. But you also have a to the power minus 2 times a to the power 4. That's just overall a factor of a squared. So we obtain that the canonically conjugate field to phi, pi superscript phi, is a squared times phi prime. Are the two canonically conjugate fields the same? No, of course not. Let's just quickly calculate them. We have that the canonically conjugate field to chi is chi prime. But chi is a phi. So a phi prime is a phi prime plus a prime phi. And we have that phi prime is pi phi divided by a squared. So we have pi phi divided by a squared. It has a factor of a that cancels here, plus this. So what we see is that the two canonically conjugate fields are not the same. So we have the phi field and the chi field, and they have each their canonically conjugate fields, and they're not the same. Now, let us quantize. The quantization conditions for the physical fields phi and pi superscript phi are the usual ones. We know that this is the thing to do from all the formalism that we developed earlier. It's covariant and everything. But now the proposition is that in terms of the fields chi, with its canonically conjugate momentum field pi superscript chi, the canonical commutation relations become these, which look just the same as those, right? This is the chi pi chi commutator is just I direct delta, and the other guy is commute. How convenient. But how true is it? Well, it's true. Only the first canonical commutation relations is non-trivial to check. Let's quickly check that. So we have chi and pi chi. And the commutator is, if we just substitute what chi actually is, namely it's a times phi, and what pi chi is, namely this expression, then we see that, and we just calculated that, we just calculated the relationship between pi chi and pi phi. It's this. So if we now calculate that commutator, we find that there's a phi that commutes with this phi, so this term doesn't matter. And then we have the non-trivial commutator between phi and pi superscript phi. But this one comes with the prefactor a, and that one comes with the prefactor 1 over a. So they just cancel, and we just get the usual commutator. So very conveniently, the new field variable chi has the same commutation relations as the phi do. So it's a fairly trivial change of variables from the physical field phi to the mathematically useful field chi. However, notice that there's something non-trivial going on. When we start with the Lagrangian, which is the Klein-Gordon action without the time integration, then we can do a Legendre transform with respect to phi prime to arrive at pi superscript phi. And the Legendre transform from the Lagrangian leads us to the Hamiltonian. So that's a Hamiltonian that we may call H superscript phi. And it is obtained by integrating the new variable times the old variable minus the old Lagrangian, as usual, just the ordinary Legendre transform. That's one way of doing this. But we can also do a Legendre transform with respect to the new variable chi prime to obtain the new canonically conjugate momentum field pi chi, and then define a Hamiltonian superscript pi, which is obtained by multiplying, you know, the old and the new variable minus the Lagrangian, everything expressed now in terms of the chi and pi. And these two Hamiltonians have no reason to be the same. So now we have, for one theory, two different Hamiltonians. I mean, they have no reason to be the same, and in fact, they are generally not the same. So then the question arises, how can both Hamiltonians be valid generators of time evolution? And which one of them is gravitating? Which one of them is causing curvature? But first of all, how can both Hamiltonians be generators of time evolution? How can we have that I times phi prime is the commutator of phi with its Hamiltonian, and also I times chi prime is the commutator of chi with its Hamiltonian? Both are true, we know that. But how come? Shouldn't we have only one Hamiltonian for one system? And we also have, easy to check, that the two Hamiltonians are not the same. So shouldn't we have one Hamiltonian for one system? Yes, and of course there is just one Hamiltonian for this system, and it's this one, it's H superscript phi. So what's going on then? Well, you see, if we want to calculate this with the Hamiltonian H superscript phi, the physical Hamiltonian, then we have to take into account that chi is a variable that has an explicit manually implemented time dependence in addition to its natural time dependence. Because chi is defined as scale factor times phi. And the scale factor has some extra time dependence in there. Right? And so if you remember, if you take an ordinary quantum mechanics, or in fact classical mechanics, where it's Poisson brackets, if you write down the Heisenberg equation of motion for any observable, then I times the time derivative of that observable is the commutator of that observable with the Hamiltonian. And usually we leave it at that. But the full picture is that we have to add plus I times any explicit time dependence that this variable might have. And in this case, for chi, we do, because we plugged in an extra A of t. So explicitly, this looks like that. Chi is A times phi, and therefore the equation of motion that we have for the physical Hamiltonian and the physical fields expressed in terms of chi is this. We have that chi is A times phi, and or phi is chi divided by A. So therefore, this equation of motion becomes chi divided by A prime equal to that commutator. And now you see that on the left-hand side something happens. This time derivative produces two terms. There is a term where we simply differentiate the chi prime, but there's also a term where this prime differentiates the 1 over A, and we get this extra term. So what we get is that I times 1 over A chi prime is equal to this commutator here, where the 1 over A times chi is just phi again. But we also get this term, this extra term, which is what we have to put on the right-hand side. Over here it is. and so, so we have that from the perspective of using the physical Hamiltonian to generate the time evolution, we have that there's an extra term. But if we evolve chi according to its Hamiltonian obtained by its Legendre transform, then there is no extra term. So if we now compare them, these two equations, now the left-hand side is the same, we see that these two Hamiltonians must be different. So the two Hamiltonians are really different, and yet both generate time evolution. It's just matter. The only difference is that from the perspective of one, the other one has an extra term because the other variable is time has an explicit time dependence built into it. So then, since there are multiple Hamiltonians, which, if anyone, is the energy? Well, one usually defines the energy as a generator of time evolution. But we saw in this case that both of them do it, right? It's ambiguous. In the presence of gravity and doing this redefinition of the field variable, we can define many Hamiltonians. In fact, we could define other variables, completely wild variables, and get very wild Hamiltonians then from their Legendre transform. So it's ambiguous. So what we do is, with Einstein, define energy differently. We define energy not as the generator of time evolution, of which there can be many, but instead we define the energy as the thing that curves space-time. And technically this is, if you remember, the energy-momentum tensor is the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric. That is what we get on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, the energy-momentum tensor. So this is, the energy-momentum tensor is the quantity, is the energy in the sense that it is what curves space. This is what curvature is looking out for. Curvature doesn't care about what generates time evolution. Curvature cares about what is on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. And so we can now ask, how does that relate? How does this energy-momentum tensor relate to these Hamiltonians? Now, T naught naught is the energy density. So let's calculate the energy-momentum tensor, for example, for a Klein-Gordon field. For a Klein-Gordon field, the energy-momentum tensor, as we said, it's the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric up to some prefactor. The energy-momentum tensor of the Klein-Gordon field is given by this expression. It's a quadratic expression in phi and its derivatives. So this is the energy-momentum tensor for the Klein-Gordon field. Let us look at the T naught naught component, the energy density. And the energy density is, in the case of the Klein-Gordon field, when we plug in the Klein-Gordon field in here, in the case of the Klein-Gordon field on a background FRWL cosmology, where the G mu nu is A squared times eta mu nu, we obtain that the zero zero component, and that is to say the energy density, is given by this expression here. And I'll give it to you as an exercise to verify in a little calculation that this is true. So if you plug in here the metric in the coordinate system of the conformal time and the co-moving coordinates, then T naught naught, the energy density of a Klein-Gordon field, comes out to be this. So that's A, verify that. And then B, calculate explicitly what H phi is. You obtain that from the action by dropping the time integral and then do the Legendre transform with respect to phi prime. So you get the Hamiltonian H superscript phi. Now, the Hamiltonian is an energy. This is an energy density. So then the claim is that the energy, the physical Hamiltonian H phi, is actually just the sum over the energy density. So you take T naught naught with one lower, one upper index, that's the energy density, and then integrate it over space, and that is actually the energy. This is the connection between the physical Hamiltonian, the one that generates time evolution for phi, and the T naught naught, which is, by Einstein's definition, the energy that curves space. And then for comparison, you can also calculate H superscript chi and show that it is not that. It's somewhat different. Okay. That's as far as we get today.
I can't read the second to last line of your note there.
Oh, this?
Something factor.
Yeah, it's... Okay. Let me read the whole thing. In differential geometry, there's also another use of the term density. Okay? So for... here we said it's the energy density, right? But in differential geometry, there's also a notion of tensor density. And that's what you obtain when you take a tensor and you multiply it with a measure factor in the integrals. And then you get a tensor density, but that's not what is meant here. So for every tensor, say Q mu nu, there is a so-called tensor density, Q tilde mu nu, defined as Q mu nu times square root of G, the density in the measure for the integral. And so the tensor density absorbs the obligatory measure factor in integral. So that's to be distinguished from that notion of energy density here. Okay, any questions? Yeah?
So when you calculate this stress energy tensor, you use that formula, but would you get the same if you were to like vary the action with respect to infinitesimal translations and find the disrupt current? Do you get the same result as with that? Because there's...
That's what we do. We calculate the... here it is. Right. So we take the action of matter fields, so like electrons and quarks and photons, and in this case the Klein-Gordon field. So we take not the Einstein action, but we take the matter action, such as the Klein-Gordon action, and when we functionally differentiate it with respect to the metric, and then we get an expression which we call the energy momentum tensor. Now, setting variations equal to zero amounts to this. You take the full action, which is the Klein-Gordon action plus the Einstein action, and then functionally differentiate the full action with respect to the metric and set that equal to zero. You get two terms. One term is this one, right? It's the one that you obtain when you functionally differentiate the matter action with respect to the metric. And the other term is what you get when you differentiate the Einstein-Hilbert action with respect to the metric. And that is the left-hand side of the Einstein equation.
But that's not what I meant. What I mean is usually like in the first courses in quantum theory, they teach us that to calculate the stress energy tensor. They do not teach us that formula. They just teach us something like you grab your action and you consider some infinitesimal translations. then you would see that there's a symmetry in the action, and then you
current
out of that. And
if
that's the same as that, it doesn't look obvious to me.
No, it's not. It's not. In fact, what you have in mind is what amounts to the Legendre transform. And that is not the same as this, as we just saw, because you can do various Legendre transforms with respect to various variables, and you get different Hamiltonians. And you see, you can do Legendre transform not just to get a Hamiltonian. You can also, in effect, do it to get the generators of translations in space, and you would get the momenta. And so, no, the energy momentum tensor that you can define in this way from the action is generally also not symmetric. And you see that there's an ambiguity in there. Whereas with the Einstein method, if you functionally differentiate the action with respect to the metric, you automatically get a symmetric energy momentum tensor. But it's true, yeah, that there are two different ways to get to the energy momentum tensor.
But also in this case, you don't have the time translation symmetry, so you couldn't, you don't have that conserved charge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, see you on Friday then.